Welcome to Islam for Christians. This is episode 138, the Quran, Surah 83, Al-Mutaffifin, the Defrauding, Part 2. We left off last time talking about God raising people to great heights, and we're going to stay on that theme of high heights, or elevation, high elevation, let's say. You know, now moving into the third unexplained proper noun. Now, if you remember, we went over two of them in part one, and this is the third. This is tasneem. Now, just a reminder, I'm not going to read the whole surah again. You can go back to the previous Quran episode if you want to do that. Just a quick refresher here about these particular lines that I'm talking about where tasneem is. These are lines 27 and 28. And mixed with water of tasneem, a spring whence those brought near to Allah drink. This is a description of the sweet liquid that the believers will drink in paradise. And this one, once again, it comes from a word that has to do with great heights. This comes from the verb SNM, seen, noon, meme, which means to climb up. The noun version of this would be something like the summit of a mountain or the top of something. So this is the name given to both the highest and the greatest spring in paradise, but also, just as importantly, what flows from it, which is tasneem. So this drink that the believers seem to enjoy is a mixture of pure wine and the waters of tasneem. Now you might be thinking, wait a minute, Muslims are drinking wine. Well, yes, in paradise, this is permitted. But I wouldn't get too caught up in that. It's not really about physical pleasure or even wine, at least to those who are seeking things above their most base instincts here. The sweetest drink, really, is being near to God. Now, this tasneem is not great because it flows from a great height, or at least not just because it flows from a great height. At least not in the physical sense. Water running off a mountain tastes just as great as water from a well under the earth. At least I think it does. But it's not about that. It's not even about water. It's about the source. And obviously here, the source is God. The people are consuming something flowing directly from God. And that's what makes it great. So if it's not really about that, if it's not about water and it's really not about wine, why use wine as a metaphor then? Now, yes, alcohol is forbidden, at least later on in the Islamic tradition. But I think you have to give some metaphorical leeway to an ancient people here. Again, let's go back to if you're going to read this in strictly the physical sense. Just think about what was physically available to these people. Have you ever thought of the drink options in the ancient world? I mean, wine was the sweetest thing that they had. Seems ridiculous at this time, but I'm pretty sure that's actually true. Now, I'll fully admit here, I don't like wine. I don't really get it. I know I'm supposed to get it, and I know I'd be more sophisticated and cultured if I did get it, but it's just awful compared to pretty much any mass market drink on tap in the 21st century. And that's our luxury, I suppose. But 1400 years ago, the liquid options were quite limited. Like I said, in our age, you can easily substitute unhealthy sugar for unhealthy alcohol at a much lower price. And the drink will just taste better. I mean, even wine can taste pretty good if you dump enough sugar into it. Anyway, so you see why you shouldn't get caught up in the wine part of this, the specific drink. It's a red herring. It's something you are likely to focus on, but should not really focus on. Now, yes, Islam eventually prohibited alcohol, and Christian commentators really like to point this out in this surah, but it really is kind of weak sauce as far as criticisms go. There's plenty to criticize in Islam from a Christian perspective, but criticizing this is just silly. But if you really care about that sort of thing, another surah does give a similar description of this drink, or it's called tasneem, but is a bit more specific about its effects. The name tasneem isn't actually used here, but it's clearly referring to the same concept. This is surah 37, verses 45 to 47. A cup from a gushing spring is brought round for them, white, delicious to the drinkers, wherein there is no headache, nor are they made mad thereby. Now, made mad here just means intoxicated. So people won't be intoxicated, they won't get a hangover, any of the nasty stuff. They'll basically get to drink wine without consequence. And this surah I just read to you actually predates the one we're talking about right now. So this wasn't a clarification that came later. This was the description from the start. And this whole surah is full of more, shall we say, carnal descriptions of paradise. And you can go one of two ways with that. You could say that Muhammad and Islam don't fully understand the spiritual nature of the kingdom of heaven. Or you could point out that the audience at the time was very similar to that in an American city, frankly, in a modern, our time, American city, just full of people obsessed with material longings, people who have elevated base, primitive desires as the highest virtues that can possibly be attained, people who view comfort and indulgence as the greatest of goods, people who worship pleasure, unrepentant pagans. This is the audience. Now, do you try to talk to them like they were monks in the desert, or do you meet them where they are? Tasneem is not about a drink. It's about an encounter with the divine and the reward for a good life. Anything that flows from God is going to taste good, both now and in heaven. The Quran says of tasneem, a spring whence those brought near to Allah drink. Okay, so that's enough on tasneem. And since we finished tasneem, that actually means we have gotten through all the proper nouns in this surah. That is, if you listen to part one. Now, this surah, in this way, it's kind of a unique thing. So if you're not into diving into specific words, I apologize. But this surah is just so full of them. And there's one more. Okay, we have gone over Sijin and Iliyin, or Iliyun, whichever one you want, and those are important. Now, this is the only place in the entirety of the Quran that you'll see those words. Again, this, like I said, this is a very unique surah. But there is still, oh, I should mention Tasneem too. That would be the third of those, Sijin, Iliyin, Tasneem. But there is yet another unique word I haven't gone over yet. And it's pretty important too. And it is mentioned here and only here as well. And I'm actually talking about the title of this surah. Al-Mutaffifin. Now, that word, it's a mouthful, and it's kind of fun to say. It's a bit hard to say too. And it's even harder to look at in the Arabic, at least for me. It really runs together. You know, whether in Arabic or English, it's an unusual word. A lot of F and E sounds that, again, just kind of cram together. And if you don't look at it very closely, you'll miss a sound. Now, this is the first line of this surah. Woe to the defrauders. Now, who are the defrauders? They are the Al-Mutaffifin. This is what gives the surah its title. However, defrauders is inadequate for what is being expressed here. Not wrong, but perhaps inadequate. And again, you got to give it a title. You got to give it an English word. I understand that. That's not a criticism. But there's more to it. Now, some use defrauders, and it's a good description of a wicked person, but I prefer the translation, those who give less than what is due. Again, that would probably make a lousy title. I would make the title defrauders as well, but again, there's more to it. Now, both are good, but the second is more descriptive, and it's a hint at the more total nature of this world. Total meaning it is meant to capture a larger, more all-encompassing set of wicked behaviors simply than defrauding people. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's just unpack this word a little bit. Now, this is a huge word, but like any classic Arabic word, it comes from a three-letter verb. In this case, ta, fa, fa, tff, ta, fe, fe. Now, that's not a simple T, that's a ta, which may have been lost on you, given my god-awful Arabic pronunciation, but it is properly ta, fe, fe. Now, in verb form, this means to be scant or stingy, to be small or deficient or insignificant, you know, and to act in those ways. Now, on that alone, you can see the statement being made here about the nature of the people who are being denounced, but let's go through the layers of this, these things that are implied in that single word. Again, because it's not this meaning, this definition, it's really these. For example, the most common translation here, woe to the al-mutafifin, woe to the defrauders. Now, defrauders, in my culture at least, this is not a word with spiritual connotation. It usually indicates a financial crime or something related to money. Now, even if a fake holy man defrauds someone, it usually means he took his money, not that he stole his soul. Now, that's not to say that the Quran does not denounce financial fraud here. That's pretty obvious, but that's just the start here. It's why the surah starts with weights and measures and moves quickly into the real topic. The deeper meaning of the double meaning of defraud here, at least double meaning, it's about more of a spiritual fraud, of the worst kind imaginable. Now, some crooked preacher can take your money. Someone can take your money. That's bad. But isn't it infinitely worse to commit spiritual fraud, to lead someone down the path to hell? To remove all of their spiritual currency through fraud. In this case, convincing people that there will be no resurrection and no accounting for the deeds you have done on this earth. If you can move over to the spiritual world in your thoughts about fraud, then this is a very useful way to think about it. But that should also be combined with another definition that I shared with you. Woe to the al-mutafifin. Woe to those who give less than what is due. In this sense, in what way are the wicked giving less than what is due? Well, there is spiritual fraud I just talked about. Now, in terms of truth, certainly people are being given less than what is due, as in the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But they are also being sold short morally, so to speak. And it goes to a slightly larger dimension here. The wicked, specifically those being addressed in this surah, are also not giving God his due. In so many ways, too. They are not giving their hearts, now rusted over, to God the way that they should. Because he's the creator, he should be given your heart. And then we have the denial of the resurrection, the day of judgment. This is not giving God his due power. Or pretending it doesn't exist, at least, and denying God his place on top of the moral universe, his rightful and obvious authority, and denying his judgment and his sovereignty over you, God's primacy over you, and therefore not giving God your best to be stingy toward God. And al-mutafifin is stingy toward God. And that's why I gave you the list of verbs related to this word to think about it a bit deeper. To be scant or stingy. To be stingy toward God. In Christianity, we would probably call that giving God your first fruits. Now, it's also possibly what started this whole business with Cain and Abel way back at the beginning of the Bible. You know, they were just, Cain was being an al-mutafifin. Because God did not like Cain's sacrifices. Why? Because he was just giving him whatever he had around. But Abel sacrificed his best, his first fruits. That's where that term comes from. The old days of food and animal sacrifices. But it really applies to everything. Your heart, your mind, your time, your passion, your resources. It's why Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. To do anything else is to be stingy toward God. And that applies to us all, often. It's another reason Christians need a redeemer. But back to the surah, back to those who are being denounced here. Those who are stingy toward God, those who do that, you know, in the Arabic, are also small and deficient and insignificant, which is another useful descriptor here. Humans are insignificant next to God. But in the end, that only applies to the wicked ones, because insignificant man will be raised to God. The wicked, however, will remain small and deficient and insignificant. And to a lesser extent, that applies on earth as well, but that's not really part of this surah. Maybe. This is such a great word, al-mutafifin. That's why I had to go over it. Given that, it's actually kind of stunning. This is its only use in the entirety of the Quran. And that's one reason I want to make sure I do go over it. I don't want to shortchange it. And with the al-mutafifin, we also see another common theme in the Quran. And I'll end on this topic. The idea that when men seem to prosper, that prosperity is always temporary. Oftentimes here on earth, it's temporary, but certainly, for sure, in the long arc of the hereafter, it is always temporary, 100% of the time. So you have these al-mutafifin, who appear to be on top, but they only believe this because they are ignorant and short-sighted. Now these are the last 8 lines of this surah. Lo, the guilty used to laugh at those who believed, and wink one to another when they passed them. And when they returned to their own folk, they returned jesting. And when they saw them, they said, Lo, these have gone astray. Yet they were not sent as guardians over them. This day it is those who believe who have the laugh of disbelievers, on high couches gazing. Are not the disbelievers paid for what they used to do? Now, that was the Marmaduke Pickthall translation. Actually, let me give you the Mustafa Kitab for these lines as well, because it's a bit clearer, I think. And as you listen to these lines from the Mustafa Kitab version, just think about where you are right now. Whether Christian or Muslim, think about the people with power over you who do not deserve that power. Especially if these are people who openly mock God, who laugh at believers, who mock our values, who outwardly hate everything we stand for. Think of these people, be it a lighter Western-style anti-religious culture, or perhaps a more heavy-handed tyranny in a place like China. Now think of these people, and think of your situation, and think, are these words comforting to me? Indeed, the wicked used to laugh at the believers, wink to one another whenever they passed by. and muse over these exploits upon returning to their own people. And when they saw the faithful, they would say, "These people are truly astray, even though they were not sent as keepers over the believers." But on that day, the believers will be laughing at the disbelievers. As they sit on canopied couches looking on, the believers will be asked, "Have the disbelievers not been paid back for what they used to do?" Now, obviously, this is probably very comforting for Muslims to hear, and to be honest, many Christians. There is a very large part of me that actually finds that thought kind of cathartic, because it feels great to be right, doesn't it? Now, the saints, on the other hand, they're a different story. They would be either jumping off the couches in an attempt to save the disbelievers, or if, you know, it's quite probable it's just too late, they would probably be weeping for those who have been lost. Now, admittedly, I am conflicted listening to that, because it's just basic Christian sensibilities that are just hardwired into my head. Do I really have a right to laugh at the punishment of the wicked, especially after all the wicked things I have done and thought and truly hoped to do and may have done if I had been more powerful? Now, there is an element of mocking in this that makes me uncomfortable, and I don't think I'd be happy in that situation. Well, maybe a bit, and I'd feel bad about it. But on the other hand, I would certainly be happy to be where I was, as opposed to the alternative. But just a general caution when you're reading the Quran or really any other religious text, sometimes you can get a bit too bogged down in a very specific element of something. You know, something that is trying to explain the transcendent to those of us who are not transcendent, like the wine earlier on. So in here, you have the high couches and the laughing here. It's part of a larger picture, if you think about it. It's a larger theme than just that. It's being said to a specific audience at the height of their persecution. This should be very familiar to Christians. Yes, these people are laughing at you now. Yes, they believe themselves to be more powerful now. Yes, they consider you to be stupid and weak and pathetic. But it will not always be this way. God will take down the powerful, and he will raise the weak. Or, as Jesus put it, the last will be first, and the first will be last. And the only thing in question is, precisely, how long this reversal will take. Thank you, and I'll talk to you next time. Insha'Allah. Thank you for listening to Islam for Christians. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to keep this show ad-free, you can also visit my Patreon page and subscribe. I'm at patreon.com/islamforchristians. That's patreon.com/islamforchristians.